Welcome to In Your Nature podcast with me, Ricky Whelan.
And with me, Niall Hatch. We're both with Birdwatch Ireland and we're delighted to have you along for another one of our episodes. And I'll start as we always do by saying the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. And this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
Niall, I'm delighted today. I'm really thrilled to be talking about such a cool species in the Barnal.
Oh yeah, one of my favourites. I'm looking forward to this one very much because it's a species I think that it's just iconic. A lot of people in Ireland would think of it as the Late Late Show owl, that one that you see in the opening credits. There's something really magical about them. And it's a bird that, almost uniquely actually in the world of birds of prey and in birds like that, nobody really has any negative view about them. They always just engender this wonderful affection that people have for them. And of course, you see them so rarely that when you do, it's a real landmark event. Like everyone remembers when they see an owl.
Yeah, they do. And yeah, Barnals are just totally special. Don't know if it's their colour, don't know if it's the face shape, don't know if it's the sort of, the mystery around them because they're nocturnal like a lot of other owls and all that sort of stuff. They're just fascinating creature. Might start off with you, if you would be so kind as to describe them, because unfortunately they are widespread, but they're not terribly sort of omnipresent or common. So people won't probably have seen that many of them if they've ever caught a glimpse of one.
Yes, yeah. So they are widespread across Ireland, but the population density isn't very high, and a very wide range. Actually, they're found across most of the world. They're a species you find across Asia and through the Americas and some Caribbean islands and so on through into Australia. So they're very, very widespread species, and they look a bit different depending on where you see them in their range. But the basic structure is the same, and the way they look here in Ireland is that they're a very, very pale owl. So very white on the face and down onto the chest. And then the back is this lovely, gorgeous, sandy brown colour, a very light brown, with this lovely mottling and waving in them. If you see a barn owl feather up close, it's just one of the most beautiful things. The pattern is just so subtle. The thing you first notice about them, I suppose, though, is their face. They have this big heart-shaped facial disc. So this ruff of feathers that goes around the side of their faces. And this is an adaptation that directs sound waves efficiently in towards their ears. It's a bit like a satellite dish. It's sort of like a parabolic dish. It gathers the sound waves in and directs them to their ears. One ear is higher than the other, so they're able to detect the slight difference in how long that the sound takes to hit one ear before the other. They're able to pinpoint exactly where their prey is. So they can hunt in complete darkness. They rely on their eyesight. They don't echolocate the way that bats do or anything like that, but they have very, very good eyesight. They can see even just by starlight in very low light levels. But even in complete darkness, even when there's no light, they will still hunt because they have this amazing ability to build up a mental map of their surroundings. So they know where all the tree branches are and the gateposts and the hedges and all of those different obstacles. So they can fly around those without hitting them, and they zoom in and zone in on their prey and the rustles that the mice and so on that would make as they're going through the leaf litter. So they're very effective like that. The eyes are right in the front of their face. They're very dark eyes, so it gives them this sort of big wide-eyed appearance. And so that's quite noticeable about them. And owls' eyes are quite different from those of most other birds. They're more like human eyes in many ways, because most birds, their eyes are widely spaced. They're on the sides of their heads. If you look at a crow or a blackbird in your garden, you'll see that. Their eyes are right on the side. They have a big wide field of view all around their heads. But owls have their eyes right in the front of their faces, just like we humans do. So I think that's one of the reasons perhaps why people find them so endearing. They look like little people. So they have a narrow field of view, kind of like the way that we do, but they can compensate for that by being able to turn their head through 270 degrees. So they can't keep spinning it round and around like other people think they can, but they can turn it almost all the way over one shoulder and then round the other way over the other shoulder, which gives them great all-round view. And one of my favourite things, of course, about them as well is their adaptation to flight. They have the special sort of fluffiness in the edge of their feathers, which means that they are silent in flight. You do not hear them when they fly past, and therefore the mice that they eat don't hear them either. So it's completely silent. I think that's sometimes if you have a close encounter with one, that's kind of why it can be so surprising. All of a sudden this ghostly apparition appears out of nowhere. You never heard it, and all of a sudden there it is in front of you. With these big staring eyes in front of you, there's just something really otherworldly about them. I think they're magic.
Colour, people describe them as a white owl, but they're not really white. And another funny thing about them is that the British and the Irish owl especially are particularly pale in colour. But the further east you go and in the Americas, they're quite a rufous bird.
Yes, they are. And in places like the Netherlands, you get a mixture of both. You have the dark-bellied barn owls and the pale-bellied barn owls. And nobody until, well, at least until recently, was quite sure why you had different appearance for these owls, why that would be. Does one have an advantage, one have a disadvantage? One of the theories now is that perhaps it can. It seems that particularly when there's a lot of light in the sky, like full moon or something, the white breast of the very pale owls can help actually to dazzle their prey. Strange as that may seem, they just get transfixed by this white shape in the sky. Sometimes at more northerly latitude, this may be an advantage. Nobody's quite sure of that. But it is interesting that these two different colour forms do occur across Europe, and one hasn't replaced the other. Both still do exist. So you have it when you go from, as you said, from Ireland and in Britain, in this western part, in Spain and Portugal as well, they're quite pale. Then when you get to sort of the Netherlands and then through Germany into Austria, that kind of area, they become quite dark on the belly. But then when you get back to the Middle East, they become pale again. So when you see them somewhere like Cyprus or Israel, they're very pale once again. And that sort of pattern sort of changes as you go across the world. You know, I've seen some of the ones in the Caribbean, for example, and they're really dark on their faces, and you wouldn't think it was a white bird at all. But you still know it was a barn owl. They still have that amazing, like, heart-shaped face, that lovely teardrop-shaped body, and those long feathered legs. There's just something that just seems, I think, so calm and relaxing about them. They never seem to be that stressed. They always seem to be quite easygoing birds, I think.
Male and female. Are they separable? Can you, if a male and female flew past, could you separate them?
No, I don't think I could. No, I think that there's too much overlap between them. Sometimes you can, especially with the dark bellied one, some would be a bit paler or darker than the others. But no, not reliably so. A lot of that would depend actually on in the hand measurements. They look so similar. And of course, we rarely get to see them very well either. When you do glimpse an owl, it's just one that's maybe drifted across the road in front of your car, or maybe you see one far off, maybe up on a perched on a fence post, and then you know you can't get any closer than that.
They're monogamous, so they pair for life unless one of them sort of dies prematurely or whatever. But they interestingly will roost apart. So you talk about the ghostly apparition, but they choose to roost in sort of, you know, mad old places, sort of abandoned cottages, castle rooms, old burnt down churches, and all sorts of places. So the ghostly apparition really, really does fit for the sites they select to roost.
Yeah, it does. So it's a bird that's long been associated, yes, with ruined castles and old churches, particularly graveyards. You see this ghostly white shape just floating across this graveyard after dark. And then, of course, what we haven't done, we haven't mentioned the sound that they make. And I think that that's a big reason for why people find them maybe quite spooky when they see them in such a setting.
I won't say I'm afraid of the dark, but I get creeped out quite easily, and I've heard that when I've been in some sort of castle ruins and stuff, and it is so spine chilling. It's crazy, and it gave rise to all those banshee stories and all that folklore about them, and they've got 100 names because of that ghost bird and witch's bird and all these sort of things. And I think anyone that's ever heard that sound in the middle of sort of the night will know why.
Yes, it's definitely the origin of the banshee. That's what it is. This ghostly white shape floating in the sky, make this blood-curdling scream. And elsewhere in the world, there's all these associations as well with sort of the underworld, or with the spirit world. And the people have thought in some places that they're actually goblins, or that they're evil spirits and so on. And that, unfortunately, over the years had led to their persecution in some areas. And sometimes people in less enlightened times would see these birds as being a threat or being an ill omen. But I'm glad to say, at least in Ireland and across most of Europe today, that's no longer the case. People do welcome them. So although that sound would put your heart sideways if you come across it, once you realise what it is, you realise what a privilege it is to actually be in the presence of such an amazing bird. And where I live here on the East Coast, I live in North County Wicklow, barn owls in this part of Ireland are few and far between. We don't see them that often. But last summer, there was one actually hanging out around Greystones Village for a couple of weeks. And fly over my house around midnight, you just hear that sound in the sky, fly quite low over the streetlights. And I was just amazed that there's a barn owl over my garden. I never thought I'd see it.
Amazing, really beautiful experience. They make a certain life stage of theirs, they make another strange sound, maybe a sound people will be familiar with if anyone has ever spent a night in the same house as a man that's had a few pints. They snore. They can snore, can't they?
Yes, it really does sound like snoring. Let's play it there so people hear for themselves. Yeah, snoring. No better description. That's exactly what it is. But less terrifying maybe than the scream was, although I'm sure people maybe with snoring partners may disagree. That's what puts their heart sideways to hear that sound. But yeah, quite a different vocalization and one that you'd often hear around the nest particularly.
Yeah, it's made by the juveniles, by the youngsters, the chicks begging for food. That's how they do it. So at a certain stage in the summer when the chicks are of a certain size, you'll hear this snoring coming from sort of, you know, barn owl boxes and roofs of old sheds and any sort of chimneys and all sorts of places that they select to nest in. And it's really wonderful. It's a strange sound out to hear again. And it has been mistaken for sort of people actually snoring in buildings, because you hear it coming from an old cottage. You're like, God, someone still lives there. But yeah, it's a good one. Another way, people will seldomly see them, and they can tuck themselves away quite well when they're roosting during the day, and they'll even sort of change roost side across the day depending on their preferences and, you know, the angle of the light and all that sort of stuff. But you mightn't see them, but they often leave signs, including pellets, which are often found near the roost or the nest sites.
Yes, that's one of the main ways to find owls and indeed other birds of prey, and also how we work out what they've been feeding on, because they leave the traces behind them. So what owls and many birds of prey will do is, because they don't have teeth, when they catch something like a mouse or a shrew, they'll just swallow it down whole. And what they do is then they let the digestive system take care of removing the nutrients and the flesh and all of that. And then what happens is they then regurgitate the indigestible parts. So these pellets that they cough up, they are really sort of cylindrical bundles, mostly made up of mouse hair. But inside that, you'll find loads of little skulls and teeth and leg bones, all these things that they couldn't digest. And from analysing those pellets, which are often found around the roost sites, they just cough them up there or around the nest. Then when you analyse them, you can put them in warm water and dissect them with a tweezer. You'd be surprised, first of all, how many individual little animals that bird has eaten in one night. But then also you can work out exactly what they're doing. I was actually through analysis of those barn owl pellets that was discovered that a new creature called the greater white-toothed shrew, an invasive alien species, had arrived in Ireland, because it first turned up in barn owl pellets. Not many animals will eat shrews, but owls happily will. Apparently mammals avoid shrews because they taste repellent. They have this terrible odor and a terrible taste, but owls, like most birds, don't have much by way of a sense of taste or smell, so they don't mind it. And that's how it was discovered in the owl pellets.
Very interesting, and that teases up nicely for the interview that we're about to hear. And we couldn't possibly have a barn owl episode without including our raptor conservation officer John Lusby, who is, for the last it's 15 years or more now, he's been Mr. Barn Owl in the country, and he's done an awful lot of research and monitoring of barn owls in Ireland. And I interviewed him early this week. So I first started off by asking him how he personally got into barn owls.
Going back to as a kid, you know, I think the same with everyone. Like, I have very, very clear memories of encounters with barn owls, you know, as a child. And I think, you know, that interest, just, you know, that captured me. And I suppose because of that, you know, maybe that was a subconscious kind of, you know, directed towards barn owls when I was starting out.
Cool, yeah, that makes sense. No, they're stunning. They're amazing. I know, like a lot of people sort of got crazy about owls after the whole Harry Potter thing, and I know there was like lots of exotic owls being bought as pets back during that period, which is a bit crazy, and I'm sure barn owl conservation benefited somewhat from that as well. So what is the status of barn owls in Ireland and this part of Europe, I suppose?
I never thought I'd be saying this, but it's actually looking quite positive. Barn owl populations are increasing in Ireland, at least in certain parts of the country. And that's it's a pretty dramatic turnaround from even a few short years ago. And I remember when I started first working on barn owls, you know, the situation was quite bleak. And even from, you know, a basic perspective, I remember, you know, checking so many, you know, suitable runes and just drawing blanks, not finding any birds. They were very scarce at that stage. Also, we had invested, you know, a lot of effort into providing nest boxes, and we were getting very little return, very little occupancy of the nest boxes. So at that point, you know, there would have been, you know, I think, like, at least in terms of, we would have had knowledge of about, you know, 30 or more pairs at that point, which is obviously quite low. Very, very different situation now. And I think it's definitely the fortunes of barn owls have changed. I would love to say it's, you know, predominantly down to conservation efforts and down to, you know, improvements in habitat and provision of nest boxes and all. But and definitely, you know, those aspects definitely have helped. But I think it's probably the most influential factor for barn owls has been the arrival of introduced small mammal species, particularly the bank vole and the greater white-toothed shrew. So, you know, quite an artificial recovery, if you will, if you can put it that way, but a recovery nonetheless. And we are seeing a real significant change in particularly in Munster, where traditionally was the barn owl stronghold, a real turnaround, increase in numbers, increase in, you know, numbers of nest boxes occupied. So it definitely is going in the right direction. But that's, you know, only in recent years, only in the last 5 or so years.
This now really jars with the conversations me and Niall normally have, because we're like very doom and gloom, because unfortunately that's just the status of many of the species we have. But it's great like that since, like, even in the short few years since, like, I back in the day before I was working for Birdwatch Ireland, I mean, I looked up so much to you and Alex and all the work you're doing. And like, when I was only in college, I was going out with you on some field work in sort of in East Galway and West Offaly, listening for barn owls. And like, you would get super excited when you'd find a site, because at that time they were just, I mean, they were not doing as well as they are now. It's crazy, and it's brilliant in just those few short years to be able to sort of have seen that happening. But like I say, it wasn't all the same, and people won't actually know that, like Ireland is pretty impoverished for species and small mammals. I mean, it's an island nation. It's not influenced by sort of, like, you know, you don't have, animals don't have the same options to come and go like they would on the continent. So we don't have the same sort of number of prey species available to our birds of prey and stuff. So it's amazing that that's even a factor. But I suppose, again, they're still under a lot of pressures. So tell me a little bit about the conservation pressures barn owls are under, and what sort of got them down to the low ebb they were at one point.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I suppose not to paint, you know, a false sense of security in terms of the population status. Obviously, they are increasing, but it's starting from a very low base of, you know, after decades of declines in the population, really reaching, you know, quite a low and almost, you know, critical level. And a lot of the factors that have caused that decline are still there. So it's really, you know, we're seeing the increases in recent years, but it's really, you know, the onus is on us to make sure that remains the case, and that we implement the measures to ensure that we, you know, secure the population. And so some of the factors that affect barn owl populations that are, you know, responsible for the declines in the first place would be, I suppose, look, you know, you know as well as I do, when we talk about barn owls being, you know, a bird of farmland, and we see, you know, so many of our farmland birds, you know, in trouble, declined, like, so, you know, the likes of yellowhammer, corncrake, curlew. So, and similar with barn owl, you know, that the probably, you know, the main reasons for the declines are the changes in farming practices, intensification of farming. And I suppose for barn owls, that would mean, you know, less available in terms of foraging habitat, nest sites, increased use of pesticides, particularly rodenticides, which are rat poisons. Obviously, barn owls feeding to a large extent on small mammals, on rodents, are particularly susceptible to secondary poisoning to rodenticides. So those problems, those issues are still there. As well, barn owls are very susceptible to being killed on roads, and particularly major roads. And again, that, you know, that is still a serious problem for barn owls. Something that we've tried to do something about, but I think that'll be quite a long road. Excuse the pun. So a lot of the problems are still there. They still affect barn owls, but I think as well as other species. But overall, you know, we are seeing the, you know, the slow population recovery. But as I say, you know, it's hugely important to make sure that, you know, we're not, you know, having this conversation 5 years, 10 years from now and talking about barn owl population declines again. So it's, you know, it's given us, even though it's, you know, it's quite an artificial recovery, it's given us a you know, a unique opportunity to make sure that remains the case. And it's all about, you know, improvement of habitat restoration, as well as providing the nest sites. They're really the you know, what provides benefits for barn owls as well as other species.
Absolutely, and I mean we see that quite a lot. You'll focus on a particular species, but the cascade effects for loads and loads of other species, bird species and other species groups, by improving habitat for barn owls is just colossal. The overall environmental health is going to sort of increase. You're going to get more insects, you're going to get more small mammals, you're going to get more birds, you're going to get more plants, and it's just, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, so it's really good. You kind of listed three main things that stuck out with me with regards to the limitations on barn owls, the sort of lack of housing, so barn owl boxes, shall we say. One sort of counter sort of action to that, you talked about rodenticides and rat poisons and that, and road collisions. Over the years, you've done projects, or you currently have projects on the go, sort of addressing all three of those things. So can you give us some examples of the work you've done to address those three sort of issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I'll start with the road collisions, because that's quite recent in terms of research that we carried out. And I suppose we started out, you know, it wasn't something that we initially set out to do, was to, you know, to look at the impacts of roads on barn owls. But it was something that kind of naturally became, you know, quite prominent, because we were, you know, learning of a lot of barn owl mortalities on roads, and we were seeing that ourselves. And also certain roads seem to be particularly problematic, and the M8 motorway, or at least sections of it, which is the motorway that runs between Cork to Dublin, seem to be a real hotspot for barn owl road deaths. So we were able to partner with Transport Infrastructure Ireland, and we developed a research study to essentially learn more about the extent of barn owl mortalities in roads, what was influencing risk of mortality, but also, you know, importantly, what we could do about it. And that was very insightful. We learned a lot from that. We were able to employ some new technology, which was such as using GPS transmitters on adult birds, which gave us an incredible insight as to, you know, their movements in the landscape, but particularly how they used or avoided major roads. And what we saw was that they were very much attracted to hunt along the roadside verges. And obviously the reason for that being is because they can be, you know, really important for small mammals. And we see it, you know, when we're driving motorways during the day, you often see kestrels hovering above the grass verges of motorways, and obviously, you know, they're looking for the same prey species as barn owls. So we were seeing that effect, that birds were drawn into, you know, the motorway verges, but obviously with that could increase risk of collision. So, and we were also seeing that it was predominantly young birds during their dispersal period that were being killed on roads. So there were other components to the research as well, but ultimately it culminated in trying to develop mitigation which would preserve the benefits of the grass verges that are created with major roads, with motorways in particular, but obviously reduce the risk of collision. And so we developed mitigation measures which were alongside Transport Infrastructure Ireland, which were then adopted by them, to essentially create a natural screening close to the road to try and deter birds from flying at the height of oncoming vehicles, but also to allow them, you know, kind of to continue to forage along the motorway verges, but, you know, where they were protected from that natural screening. So that is now adopted by Transport Infrastructure Ireland, and is now a requirement for all new road developments, which is great. So that there's still a body of work to assess its effectiveness, and I'm sure there'll be, you know, tweaks required in the future, but just to be at that point is fantastic, and hopefully it'll have a positive impact. So I think it just shows, you know, where research can be brought into, you know, to practical conservation measures and practical mitigation measures in this case. So that's something that has come, that has been, you know, quite positive, and, you know, and hopefully will continue to be so. I suppose with the rodenticides, that is one that's maybe much more of a slow burner, and you know, it is quite difficult to tackle. And I suppose, again, barn owls being one of the species, it really is, I suppose, a poster bird. Barn owls and red kites, maybe a poster bird for rodenticide poisoning, for good or for bad, in that they are very susceptible to rodenticide poisoning because of their diet, because they feed to a large extent on rodents, on rats and mice. So what happens is people put out rodenticides, put out rat poison, obviously with the aim of controlling rats and mice, but the problem with these toxins is their, you know, their effects can be indiscriminate. They can obviously affect rats and mice that they're targeted for, but a whole range of other wildlife. And when species and small mammals in particular become contaminated, then if they're taken by a predator such as a barn owl, red kite, buzzard, kestrel, or mammals such as, you know, pine marten, stoats, then these poisons are passed up through the food chain and can accumulate in the top predators. So we carried out a study quite a few years back, funded by National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Department of Agriculture, which looked at exposure of rodenticides in barn owls, and the results were not unexpected, but very very worrying. So we found out of 69 barn owls that we tested, over 88% had were exposed to rodenticides, and some with quite high concentrations. And actually, the concentrations were three times greater than a comparative sample of barn owls in the UK. So really points to the fact that, you know, rodenticide poisoning is a secondary poisoning, is a serious problem in Ireland. But also as well, we now know it's not just barn owls; it affects, you know, a wide range of wildlife. And in fact, if you think about it, like, you know, we now know that, you know, say for example, invertebrates and the likes of slugs and snails and beetles, they can enter bait stations to, you know, consume bait. And obviously, if these compounds are getting into the lower levels of the food chain, then, you know, the breadth of species that they can affect are vast. So that's something we were integral to the establishment of the Campaign for Responsible Rodenticide Use in Ireland, which is definitely having a positive impact. But I think that there's no two ways about it. Rodenticide poisoning still remains a serious issue in Ireland, and there's a lot more work still to be done.
I've seen a nice piece just on the TV last night that you did together with a farmer and Ella McSweeney, and the farmer had a... He'd kicked all his sort of rat poison and bait stations in lieu of a barn owl pair on his farm, which I just thought was a lovely story.
It is. It's great. Nicky Murphy, what a character. And if there's anybody more enthusiastic than barn owls in the country, I'd say that award would go to him. But but there are many others like him, and it's such a positive story to tell. So just to give the background there, he used to, by his own admission, use a few buckets of rat poison each year, but then put up a barn owl nest box. Initially he noticed barn owls are nesting in a hollow cavity in a beech tree, which is just outside the front of their house, but subsequently put up a nest box, and the birds are happily residing in the nest box. But since the barn owls have taken up residence, he noticed he didn't have to use rat poisons anymore. And then to protect the birds, he stopped using and hasn't opened a bucket of poison since. So, and again, like, if you go back like a few generations, like, you know, barn owls were the best means of natural rodent control, and that's probably one of the reasons why they are, you know, so well loved, so popular in Ireland, because of, you know, it was seen as incredibly lucky to have a pair of barn owls nesting in the farmyard, because of the fact then, you know, that they were doing all the work in terms of rodent control. So it's just great to hear, you know, in more modern times, you know, the story from Nicky and from other farmers of, you know, being able to stop using rat poison and letting barn owls do what they do best. And then it's a win-win, you know, they're providing a nest box, the barn owls are benefiting, they're benefiting for the role the barn owls are playing. So it's a far more natural balance, and I think, you know, we need to move more in that direction. And even if it's not, you know, barn owls, that there are other means of controlling rodents if rodent control is necessary, rather than resorting to rodenticides, to poisons.
Totally. And it's lovely to see that tradition return to farming, that they live alongside with the, you know, the natural predator, and it's a win-win, like you say. And I mean, there's examples of it all across Europe throughout history where provision for barn owls in various buildings around houses and farms was made to encourage them to nest and to do just what you've described there. So it's really great. And again, you mentioned in Nicky's story there that he put up a barn owl box. So it's not people will be familiar with boxes, but barn owl box, there's a bit more to it. Maybe it's a bit more finesse than just sort of nailing it to the nearest tree. So maybe just talk about, give us some details of the design, the location, and maybe the positioning, I suppose, would be the three things you'd think about putting up a barn owl box.
Yeah, so with barn owl box, the same with nest boxes with other species, you're essentially trying to recreate what the, you know, natural nest sites or what the birds are looking for and based on their nesting requirements. So with barn owls, it's I suppose there's a few key things. One is the design of the nest box, and so we either place nest boxes in interior, within buildings, particularly sheds or barns, or else exterior boxes, which would be out on typically mature trees. The nest boxes, there's a few key things. You want them nice and deep, so that that's important, so that it doesn't create risk of unfortunately young barn owls are quite prone to falling out of nests if they can get up to the nest entrance. And if you can imagine, they're jostling for position to get fed first, and before they can fly they can accidentally push each other out. And at this time of the year, even say last night I was on a, or yesterday even I was on a rescue mission where exactly that had happened at a nest site here in Galway. So if you have a nice deep nest site, it means that the young birds can't get up to the nest entrance until they're reasonably well developed and more capable of staying in the nest. Also as well, a ledge, a landing platform to allow them to exercise when they're starting to spread the wings and start to get used to their wings, and with a lip to prevent the risk of birds taking a tumble. And obviously you want the nest boxes weatherproofed, nicely protected from the elements. Apart from that, it's it's about the suitable the site selection and choosing the areas that obviously birds are going to be naturally investigating, but also as well where birds are going to benefit. And that's both the actual specific site itself, so that it's free from disturbance, there's not a risk of say cats or other predators being able to get to the nest boxes, there's not a lot of human activity coming and going say from in and around the nest box, or if it's in a barn that it's not very very busy, but then as well in an area where there's good habitat surrounding, so obviously that birds would do well. So and we've had great success with the nest boxes. It's been hard earned, put it that way, but in terms of I remember in the early days putting up nest boxes and then going back very excitedly the next year to see is there any signs of use, and nothing for quite a few years. But it's really taken off in recent years, and I think this year we're going to have reach over 150 occupied nest boxes. Yikes. With pairs in them, and it's increasing year after year. And there's so many individuals and groups that have gone to such effort to put up a nest box as well, and it's really there's been a huge surge of interest in recent years, and it's just fantastic because it's providing such benefits. And as well as with nest boxes as well, it means that because we're choosing the nest sites, it means we can choose the best locations. And in situations, say for example, you might have an old mature tree that maybe is, there's cavities in it, might, prone to being blown down in storms, or, derelict buildings, which barn owls often occupy, which are, becoming less suitable as, over time as they start to, as they start to crumble. So with nest boxes, it means that, we're providing safe and secure nest sites. So good for the barn owls, good for us. It allows us to monitor them as well. So it's been a fantastic success. I must say with the nest boxes,
it's fantastic. We share a pal in Barry Nolan, who does a lot of work now in Laois with nest box projects, and God, he's another one that has got the bug of barn owls, and he's just in sheds and up trees all over the county, sort of putting up nest boxes, and it's great to see. And I know he's constantly sort of getting advice and feedback from yourself, so it's just great to see that liaison, that coordination, that network of people working for barn owls around the country. It's really deadly, and barn owls and Birdwatch Ireland, and we owe a lot to those people who are committed to that. We have a design for a John Lusby approved barn owl box design on our website, so if people just Google Birdwatch Ireland barn owl box or whatever, they'll find it, and they'll also find that booklet that you produced a few years ago with a design for inside of a shed as well, because you can't put them inside hay sheds and stuff, can't you?
You can indeed, yeah, yeah. They're probably the most, the nest boxes that we've had best success with is in hay sheds. And just to say, we have a video as well, which is with Alan McCarthy, who's been doing phenomenal work on Barnoles in recent years, as well as you mentioned, Barry Nolan and so many more. But we have a video as well, which is basically a how-to on Barnole nest boxes. So definitely check that out if you're interested in putting up nest boxes. Everything from the design, construction, installation, monitoring, one-stop shop. So all the information is there as well as your
brilliant. That's on our YouTube channel, is it?
It is on our YouTube channel, and loads of other videos on barnoles and habitat creation, rodenticides. Yeah, so definitely check out the YouTube channel.
Deadly. I got a lovely email the other day, an update from Deck Franks, who you'll know as well, and it was a great story. So last year, he said there was a bad storm in it was March or April, I think, and he'd been out sort of searching the local area for barnoles with very little results for a while. But after this storm, his uncle gave him a call saying, "Oh, I have a barnole here for you that got hit on the road." And Deck actually initially thought that the barnole was dead, but it was alive. So he got it to a couple of people he knows, Animal Magic, the wildlife rescue, and they nursed it back to good health and released it back at a site close to a site where Deck had some signs of barnoles. And just this summer he's confirmed a pair breeding. So it looks like that injured bird went from sort of close to death to sort of dusting itself off and getting back up and running and finding a mate and producing a nest of young, which is fantastic.
It is, isn't it? And I think you said it there, like that just captures like the, I suppose, the collaboration, the teamwork, all the different people involved, like, and Deck Franks is another one that's just been quietly working away in the background, doing phenomenal work in terms of he's putting up nest boxes, he's surveying sites in his local patch in South Offaly. But yeah, that was just a fantastic story. He was sending me very, very excited messages there a few evenings ago when he had confirmed that when he was hearing snoring chicks in in a church, which is the site where they released that bird. And and incredible work by Animal Magic, who, God, there's been so many, not only barnoles, but raptors, birds in general, that have been through them and, you know, and have come out the other side being released. And so yeah, that just, I suppose, sums up the benefits of, you know, of that work and just the, you know, and there's so many people that are involved in barnoles conservation like that have just, you know, been doing amazing work over the years and with amazing results.
You just we should, before we finish up, they're not an owl that hoots, first of all. They're various different sort of, they're screech owls, I guess, but the youngsters snore. So tell me about, just talk me through their breeding ecology a little bit.
Barnoles, they've got a very long breeding season, so they'll, at the, I suppose, kind of in the run up to Christmas or towards the end of the year, you'll get the male and the female will start to become quite vocal, and they'll start to be identifying, you know, the prospecting for the nest site for the coming breeding season. And it's at that stage really you hear that characteristic blood curling screech, which is the, you know, which our barnoles are known for, which is, you know, responsible for the mitts and tails of the banshee. So that would be one of the main vocalizations of barnoles, and an amazing sound to hear, you know, on a still dark night, kind of in the winter and in the lead up to the breeding season. But then the other call that is probably my favorite sound to hear in nature is the young snoring, and it is exactly as it's described. It does sound like snoring, and I've actually, you know, quite a few encounters where people have mistaken it for, you know, actual people snoring, because, you know, it's obviously it late at night and sometimes from ruined buildings. But that is essentially the young birds begging for food from the adults, and as soon as the sun goes down, right throughout the night until the sun rises again the following morning, they'll be snoring in the nest, and it sounds like a hissing sound, and it actually can. And so at this time of the year now, from barnoule nest sites, that's what you can hear, and it can actually carry a long, long way, particularly in a still night. I've heard it from over a kilometre away from a nest site. But if you hear that sound, you know, that birds are breeding. So great sound to hear. But if you don't know you know, what's responsible. It can be quite an eerie sound, you know, particularly from a graveyard, from a ruined church.
I find castles sort of creepy at the best of times, or in the middle of the night. I don't know how you lads do it. Thanks for joining us. I will, if you humour us again for the autumn winter season, you might come back and talk about Merlin and some of the other raptors you work on as well. I think that'd be a really fascinating episode as well.
I would love to, yeah, absolutely. Count me in.
Oh, nice one, Ricky. It's always nice to hear from John, isn't it? Mr. Barnell, as you said at the start of it. No better name for him. What he doesn't know about Barnells isn't worth knowing.
Yeah, exactly. He knows his onions, and some really interesting monitoring projects he's done. I mean, you know, the various conservation issues he's looked into, the provision of barn owl nest boxes, how to sort of work out the problem with striking cars on our motorways, and you know, their foraging behaviour, rodenticides. I mean, he's really done an awful lot of work on behalf of Birdwatch Ireland over the years, which is just fantastic, and it's fantastic to see the species recovering.
It really is, and it's nice to be able to share a success story for a change, because very often in these podcasts we try to keep it as upbeat as we can, but there's a lot of doom and gloom. We're talking about declines in species, and this species is struggling, this one's facing extinction. Well, it looked like the barn owl was going that way, but through the work that John has been doing along with other groups around the country that do great work with barn owls, this species has slowly but surely been recovering, particularly in places like Munster and in Connemara. And we know that we can then replicate those conservation techniques elsewhere in the country, and indeed elsewhere in the world, and can bring similar benefits to that species elsewhere, because it's not a bird that anyone wants to lose. It's just such an iconic, beautiful bird, one of the most widespread bird species on the whole planet, yet facing challenges across that whole range. So the work that John has been doing, I think, is going to really pay off in the long run, and we'll see that species gradually returning. We've identified through careful research what the problems are, and once you know that, then you can start addressing those problems, compensating for them. And it's quite clear as well through John's work, the key to that has been involving local communities. It's important that people feel a sense of a vested pride, I suppose, in their local barn owls. This is something we've seen in communities now across the country. It's wonderful that so many people are getting behind them.
Yeah, and equally, I mean, John mentioned some of the people who are involved in barn owl conservation. I mean, he couldn't mention them all, but I'd say, like, thanks and fair play and fair dues goes to all those men and women across the country that have sort of put the shoulder to the wheel and turned around the fortunes for barn owls. And, you know, it's fantastic. I think we're both agreed, and everyone's agreed, that they're such a mega cool species. Let's cut to Bird of the Week, and I want to talk about a species that is linked to barn owls, in that it often nests in similar sites. You'll often find this sort of two of them in the same location, but this species is going to be so much more overlooked than a barn owl at these sites. And it's the feral pigeon, or the rock dove. And I want to start off to ask you, are they a separate species? Is it the same species? What is the confusion about the rock dove and the feral dove? What's the story with them?
So they are the same species in a nutshell. So they're Columba livia is the Latin name for them. So to give the origin, is in many ways the feral pigeon, the bird we're all familiar with from our city and town streets and buildings and so on. It's in some ways a man-made invention, which I think is kind of interesting. It's descended from the wild rock dove, a bird which, although it's no longer common in Ireland, it's a bird you do still find on some more remote islands and headlands and coastal cliffs. And you find it in other parts of Europe as well. Wild rock doves, they look like the most typical feral pigeons you'd see generally. They're kind of mostly grey, sort of a purplish greenish iridescence on the neck. They have two black stripes in each wing. So a lot of our feral pigeons have a similar similar plumage pattern that they got from their wild ancestors. However, the big difference is that wild rock doves tend to be really skittish. They're very shy birds. They don't let people get near them. They tend to be in quite remote areas, and so they can be very hard to see. So it's a bird that most people aren't really aware of. And if they did see them, they might think, oh, it's just one of those street rats that we see, you know, those rats with wings that you get. But in fact, they're really fascinating in their own right. However, that was one of the first wild animals to be domesticated in Europe. People kept them for centuries for various reasons. First of all, for meat and for eggs. Quite a lot of meat on a pigeon. They lay eggs quite regularly. And they also had this amazing homing ability. So it was worked out that if the birds were taken away from where they had been raised, they could fly back extremely long distances, which is really quite odd, because wild rock doves aren't migratory. They stay more or less resident in the same locations throughout their lives, so we don't quite know how this evolved. But anyway, so what happened was, then people realized, well, if we put messages on the legs of these birds, and they can carry communications between countries and over long distances. So they had this, the carrier pigeon was born, and then the sport of pigeon racing developed, and people really got into this. Now, over time, what happened was that the economic importance of these pigeons declined. People got more into things like chickens and ducks, which had more meat and larger eggs, and a lot of these pigeons, these dovecotes, were just, you know, they were just abandoned. The pigeons went wild again, and many different varieties had been bred. So some of them had like white plumage, some had brown plumage, some had sort of ruffled frills down their legs or big ruffled collars around their necks, and some had long necks, and so they looked quite different. But then what happened was, in the wild, when they got back to the wild state, they interbred with each other and pretty quickly reverted back to the wild type. So they behaved like wild birds, except they'd lost their fear of humans. So they were quite happy to go, rather than to the sea cliffs that they had an ancestral memory of, they were happy to go and nest on building ledges in urban areas. And that's really how they became to be the dominant bird species of urban areas right across the globe.
Yeah, and I mean, like you said, you talk about the sort of flying rats. You get some pretty gnarly ones in the big cities and, you know, around train stations and places like that. But they have their own charm, and they're certainly intelligent species. And, like, you know, we know a lot about, we often talk about avian intelligence in crows and the corvid family. But back during the sort of world wars and stuff, the Brits and the Yanks and everyone was putting an awful lot of money into studying these species, because they were, you know, they were handy when it came to, you know, carrier pigeons and all that sort of stuff. And they did discover they're quite an intelligent animal. You know, they're maybe not the avian Einsteins that a raven is, but they're up there, certainly.
Yes, they're very, very good at solving problems, particularly when food is involved, because they're hungry birds and they do what they can to eat. But they've had to develop a degree of intelligence, because they're social birds, first of all. And we usually see intelligence involving creatures that are highly social. There are some exceptions, like octopuses or octopoides, as I found out recently the correct plural is. They tend to be solitary, intelligent animals, but that's really the exception rather than the rule. When you look at animals like crows, parrots, monkeys, wolves, they're all pack or flock animals. And pigeons are like that too. They live in groups, so they have to read each other's moods. They have this social hierarchy. And I think that really the reason that people haven't appreciated that fully is because it's a bird, yeah, that people really overlook. They're just seen as you know, like a vermin on the streets. Whereas in fact, there's a lot more to them than that. They're very interesting. One of the things I think that I find most fascinating about them as well is that we biologists, we owe them a great debt of gratitude, because they are the creature that first sparked really the whole idea of the theory of evolution by natural selection in the mind of Charles Darwin. For anyone who's read On the Origin of Species, his seminal work about that, and if you haven't read it, by the way, I'd highly recommend it. It's surprisingly readable, and it's written in a lovely style, so I would definitely recommend that. But when you do, you might think, expect there'll be loads in there about the Galapagos Islands and all the Darwin's finches and all these, and there is a little bit when you're way through the book towards the end, but the whole start of the book, the whole thing, there's chapters about pigeons. He was a pigeon nut, and he saw these different breeds of pigeon. As I said earlier, some were really fancy with big frills on their necks or on their legs. Some are different colours. They look like they're complete, not just completely different species, but like they belong to completely different genera. But then he saw that when he bred them back together and crossbred these different strains of pigeons, again, within a few generations, they reverted back to something that looked very similar to the bird he knew as the wild rock dove. And he realised, they look very different. But what must have happened is rock doves were domesticated, and over many generations, humans bred them selectively for certain traits that they wanted to enhance. And this probably happened with dogs as well, I suppose, when they came from the wolf, and then maybe with breeds of cat. And he starts thinking about this and realizes maybe nature does the same thing. Maybe pressures from the environment, survival pressures on plants and animals, over a long time period of time, they change their appearance and their abilities in order to fit better into that world. And so it was pigeons that sparked the whole thing for him when he saw what happened when all the different breeds mingled back together again, which I think is pretty cool.
It's really cool, and people do not give them that sort of respect at all. Before we forget, let's listen to their call or their song. I find it so relaxing and subtle and just really nice.
That's one a lot of people will know, all right. It's sort of this sort of background murmuring. You'll hear it often in urban areas. It's something that sometimes you even tune it out. But you're right, it is very relaxing. There's something nice and calm about it.
It's great. It's great. And the rock doves as well, you can be alerted to them. They kind of have that wing clap thing that all pigeons do when they throw themselves off a perch or out of a tree. And often you wouldn't be sort of mind. You could be walking along some cliffs or nearby and you hear that sound and you're alerted to some rock doves taking off. So that's a good way to sort of to catch a glimpse of them. The other thing they can do, as well as you know, it's a thing in the pigeon family, is they can produce a thing called crop milk, which allows them to sort of reproduce all year almost. So you can have sort of pigeon nests active in the middle of winter, which is bizarre to us.
Yes, it is. Yes, so they do have among birds the pigeon and dove family. And by the way, you can use pigeon and dove interchangeably, we should say. They're the same thing. And sometimes people use the word dove for the cuter looking ones. But yes, they all produce this stuff called crop milk in their throats. It sounds a bit gross, but basically produced by swollen linings of the skin cells in their throat sort of slough off. Both males and females produce this. So the males make this milk as well as the females do. And when it comes time to feed the young pigeons, they actually stick their whole heads inside mum and dad's throat and start lapping this stuff up. So that's quite unusual, but you're right, that does mean that that they can breed at any time of year because they're not reliant on one particular type of food to feed their chicks. So if you're a blue tit, you want to time your breeding to coincide with the peak emergence of caterpillars, because that's the fuel that keeps your chicks going. You need the caterpillars for them. However, if you're a pigeon, when you're an adult, you can eat lots of different things. You could eat little plant shoots, you could eat grain if you find it, you might eat small invertebrates, you eat all sorts of things, but you don't need to feed that back to your chicks. What you can do is just produce this milk in your throat and feed that to the chicks so they keep them going year round. I think that's one of the reasons too why the feral pigeon has been such a successful bird in cities, because it can scavenge on basically any old rubbish and still produce nutritious food for the chicks using its throat, which is pretty cool. The other thing that pigeons can do that's often overlooked and that we humans take for granted is that pigeons and doves, the only birds in the world that can drink using suction the way that we do. So when most birds drink, what they have to do is they put their beak into water and they close their beak. They have to tilt their whole head back to use the power of gravity to take the water to their stomach. Pigeons, and pigeons alone, can stick their beak into the water and use it like a straw to suck up the water. It means they get the drinking over and done with much, much faster. It means they're less vulnerable because they don't want to be on the ground for too long. Because when they're drinking, they can't see danger coming and everything wants to eat a pigeon. So they want to get that over and done with as fast as possible and get back to the nest. So that's what they do. So we take it for granted that that's how we drink, but pigeons are the only birds that can match us.
Fascinating. No, we do take pigeons for granted, 100%. I'm glad we got to cover the rock dove, the feral pigeon in Bird of the Week. It's a nod to the train station pigeon. I think it's important we did that. It's a great one. Until next time, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks everyone for listening. As we always say, if you like listening to us, please do support our work. Birdwatch Ireland is a charity, really needs your help. If you go to birdwatchireland.ie, you can find out how to become a member, how to make donations, you can buy products from our shop. All of that helps to support us. And of course, you can find the website there. You can find out a lot more about the work that John Lusby has been doing to conserve barn owls. There's lots of interesting downloads on there, including plans you can download actually to build your own barn owl nest box, which I think is pretty cool. So just to finish by saying, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.